This is Oral History 1120, the 40th anniversary project for WIS. Today it's Alison Murchie interviewing Fliss Lord at her home in Kensington, and it's the 6th of April 2018. Firstly, Fliss, thank you very much for agreeing to be part of the project, and I really appreciate that. I should say we have company in... Fliss's cat is sitting next to me and being patted and being very sooky. But let's get some details first. What's your full name, Fliss?
Felicity Ann Lord.
With an E?
Yes.
And what was your maiden name?
That's it.
That is your maiden name.
That's it.
Because I've known you as a different name before.
I was married to a coalman for years.
Yes.
And then I remarried. Now get down, cat. I've had enough. Then I divorced. When I remarried, I went back to my married, my single name. My second husband was called Kennedy, and I didn't want to be Kennedy. That was too much of a mouthful.
Sounds fair to me. Now, what was your date of birth?
15th of April, 1947.
So you have a birthday coming up next week. Happy birthday in advance.
I'm 71. I can't believe it.
Well, I can honestly say you don't look it. But anyway, we're not here to just sit here and praise you. Where were you born, Fliss?
In Melbourne. I was the third of five children. The first child was born just before my father went to Singapore in the Second World War. And when he was demobbed, he came back to Melbourne, and suddenly my mother was pregnant with baby number two. Then he was sent somewhere else with the Air Force, and when he came back, suddenly my mother was pregnant with me. So it all happened very,
very quickly
for her. At that stage, he was not a particularly well person. I think 3 years in Singapore facing the Japanese and the loss of many of his buddies and seeing things that no person should ever see, he carried those sort of scars for the rest of his life, and very largely we knew about it.
Was it post-traumatic stress?
Yeah, of course. But of course you
didn't have a name in those days.
No. It was just something that you just had to tighten your upper lip and get on with it.
What was your father's name?
Howard. He had a beautiful singing voice, and because of that, he never did take up smoking, which meant when he did eventually come back to Australia, he didn't get any form of assistance from the government, because they only assisted those that they gave free cigarettes to. And see, he used to get cigarettes and swap them for other stuff that he wanted, but he never took up smoking because he really wanted to be an opera singer when he got home.
What did he do when he got home?
He sang around Melbourne until I was one, mainly to hospitals with recuperating defence personnel. He had three children under five, for heaven's sake, and they were paying rent. And one of my relatives back here was selling up the family property, and they gave my mum and dad a block of land to build on if they wanted to come back to Adelaide. I don't think my dad wanted to come back, but my mum did.
So they were both from Adelaide originally?
No, my mum was from Adelaide, my dad was from Melbourne. My dad's father was a customs inspector in Melbourne. A short, stocky, I believe, very handsome, black curly hair, blue eyes, Jewish man. he married a woman who wasn't Jewish, so therefore the Jewish line stopped. And he had two sisters. The younger one was a bit retarded mentally, and the older one was very intent on winning beauty contests.
Oh dear. Okay. So you moved to Adelaide, and your story's been here since. Tell me a little bit about your early employment, because you got married at what age, first off?
Oh, glory, 20.
That's what I thought it was. And you had how many children?
Three.
Yeah. So your early life was pretty busy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about when you did get into the workforce. What did you do?
Got into the work. I had lots of part-time stuff for local businesses, just bookkeeping or reception or typing, you know, that sort of
things
rubbish.
That allow you to still have time with the children and have a job.
Those were the days when women were expected to be totally responsible for children and house. And my husband at the time was a public servant who took himself very seriously. And we built a house in the hills, and every day he took the car. I think back on it now and it makes me laugh.
But you would have been a very, very typical housewife of that era.
We were all the same.
Not an unusual story.
No.
How long did the marriage last?
13 years. Yeah. Lucky 13.
Lucky 13. And then you moved on.
Well, at 13, what happened at 13 was my husband came home one day and said, I want to discuss with you our future with my superannuation. And he started to tell me that he was going to get all this money at this stage if he put all this money in now. And I didn't really understand. But what hit me the most was he said, when I'm 65, you and I will have a life together and we will have the money and the children will be grown up and it'll be just you and me. And I looked at him and I thought, I can't do that. And
so maybe that was a good conversation in the end.
I realised then that my future had to be different from that. I couldn't imagine living with this humourless, mediocre person until I was 65. And lordy, lordy, I was in my early 30s.
This woman of the 30s that's stuck in this life, how did she become the active feminist fighting for women that I met? How did you make that leap and that progress?
Well, I started off when we lived in Glen Alter, when the kids were little, and I joined school and kindergarten committees. Then at one stage I was the president of the kindy committee, and a woman came along by the name of Elizabeth Mansutti to talk to us about the effect of television on children. And I had fairly recently moved back to Adelaide from Darwin. I didn't tell you that
bit. This is the story.
We went to live in Darwin. When the cyclone came, we had to come back. Elizabeth Mansutti blew me away because I had had three children in Darwin without any television. Suddenly, here we were. My children turned into little goggle eyes. They couldn't leave it alone. And I was really worried because before that they were playing outside and reading and all that stuff. So I became very good friends with Elizabeth. One of the workers at that kindergarten at the time was a woman by the name of Pat Hempel, who also lived up in the hills and later became the president of the Children's Film and Television Association. Children's Film and Television did a lot of public speaking and media education for parents and children. And the other half, we had film festivals every international film festivals mm-hmm. every other year. When we moved down from Glen Alta down to the... We moved down because the the house got a bit small and my parents wanted to move out of the family home. So my husband and I bought the old family home on that block of land that...
From the original. Right. So where was that?
On the corner of Watson Avenue and Prescott Terrace in Toorak Gardens. Because my grandmother's family were the Prescott family and they owned a farm all around there. It's ridiculous, isn't it? You look at it now.
So that was the beginning of the change, wasn't it?
Yes,
really?
Yes.
Meeting Elizabeth coming back
Mansutti.
To
yeah. Now, Elizabeth Mansutti also is one of those people who's been on the library board for years.
Oh, it's a well-known name.
Well-known.
Yeah, very well
You've
known.
Never met her?
No, but I certainly know the name.
Oh, she's dynamite. Really, I think Elizabeth was the one who jump-started me. But when I moved down to the hills, down from the hills to the city, I started applying for jobs, keeping in touch with the people that I knew, and I was offered a job with Children's Film and Television. They, at that stage, were out at North Adelaide, and they were just about to organise yet another international festival, and they needed an extra person on board. And so I was really very pleased because they were quite happy for me to keep it to 25 hours a week so I could still be there for primary school children. Mm-hmm. At that stage, I still had a couple. And that was great. I really liked that. It was one of those jobs where you have to do everything. I spent a lot of time going out to primary schools, speaking to parents, associations, teachers, talking about the impact of television and why it was important that they try and limit children's hours, daily hours to television. And of course, meeting a lot of international people who brought their films to Adelaide to show to children, which was absolutely fantastic. I just revelled in that part too. And the filmmaking scene in Adelaide was, in those days, it was just bubbling along very nicely. I met Scott Thingamy Bob several times. He was lovely. And his wife and all sorts of people. And, of course, because we worked hand in hand with the Education Department Media Studies Unit, I got to meet a lot of teachers as well and used a lot of their knowledge as teachers of children with too much television. We also ran a state survey on videotapes. In those days, videos were very new. There was no classification
That's
system.
Right.
And we were really worried that very young children were getting access to very violent videos, and they were. The state government reeled in horror when they found out what was going on. It was very much like today when we have parents who are sexually abusing their children. This was a form of sexual abuse.
How long did you end up working there?
Oh, well, 15 years.
Oh, so huge part of your life.
Yes, yes. Well, I loved it, and it grew with me.
You both grew together?
Yes, yeah. Yes. In the end, I was working 4 days a week, which was lovely. Four was ideal for me. In the meantime, our marriage had broken up, and I was teaching my children that they shared the responsibility of the house. So we had everything was divided by four, all the housework. So 1 week you'd get vacuuming and another week you'd get all the washing and putting away and all that stuff.
So you helped them grow up properly too?
Oh, yes.
Because they got
They had to.
Yeah, they had to for the family to survive.
Yes.
And they got those life skills at the same time.
Yes.
And you're still very close with your children, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. And cooking, they all had to have a week, a month of cooking. Because by then I was a member of Women's Electoral Lobby.
Now, that's where I think I first started to hear about Phyllis Lord.
Oh, yeah.
Now, how did you get involved with, from a film industry background for children?
It's funny, isn't it?
How did you make that jump to, well, although I know many women in Adelaide were doing that same jump.
I think it was Joan Russell. I can't remember where.
Well, she was certainly one of the key movers.
When I first met Joan Russell, I thought, oh, my God, is this what a feminist is? I was so shocked. And she said something or other about the fact that I was wearing pearls and I've never worn them since. Isn't that lovely? I can't remember.
Did you consider yourself a feminist?
I didn't know what a feminist was. Okay. And I really didn't know. It was about that time
So Joan introduced you to feminism as well?
Yeah.
And that sort of
Joan, and it was meeting Joan that I bought the book, The Women's Room. And reading The Women's Room, I signed up with Women's Electoral Lobby. The Women's Room had an amazing impact on me. And from there on, I just went on to, I met Anne Summers and all these amazing books that were around. And, of course, we had the women's bookshop down on the Norwood Parade with Fidge. Oh, to die for. And I just leapt in feet first. I know I alienated a lot of people especially my estranged husband. He went off the branch at house. He actually went so far as to say, I really should go and see a psychiatrist.
Did that sort of comment bother you?
Yes, it made me angry. Now I laugh at it, but it did make me angry because I had discovered this fantastic thing that was going to make my life worthwhile, I couldn't understand why other people didn't see it also. What was wrong with my parents and my siblings and my ex-husband? They were all stupid.
I think you were proved right. And, I mean, the reason I'm saying that is because some women would be put off by that sort of... disapproval by family, but your story is similar to a lot of the women that I'm interviewing. Once they'd found the light of feminism through whatever source, there was no looking back.
No.
And you fit into that as well?
And the fights it caused. Mm-hmm. Oh, my father wouldn't talk to me and my mother just burst into tears and said, darling, look what you're throwing away. And I couldn't convince her that what I was gaining.
Okay. Now the purpose of this interview is to really find out, how did you hear about WIS and what did you know about WIS?
Well, after being in Women's Electoral Lobby for a while, of course with people like Betty and Barbara Polkinghorne. Now Barbara was a part of the Women's Liberation Movement. She was gorgeous. She was a wonderful influence for me and mentor. And our meetings, we were the Women and Media Committee, Barbara and there were six of us. And we used to meet down underneath my plum tree with a box of red wine on every second Saturday. And we met there simply because I had three kids that were coming and going and I couldn't just walk out on a Saturday and leave them alone.
I can almost see this little group of collaborators there with their glass of red.
Yeah. God, boy. And, of course, in those days also, my mother was on the committee of Cottage Homes, which is just up the road, and Barbara became homeless. She had 3 months to get out of her room that she was renting, and I got her into cottage homes. So she was living just up the road from me, and she was so happy. So when we got this media group together, she could just come down the road and I'd put the red wine in the middle of the table and away we went.
There's got to be a link here. I've had so many people in the feminist movement and red wine. There's a very strong connection there. Maybe there's a thesis there for someone. It's certainly a strong story. Yeah. Sorry, I'm sidetracking.
But we had to limit it to one box of red wine.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, Barbara was very women's Libras.
Oh yes, women's Libras. Yeah. Yep.
They also scared me a bit because they were very outspoken, very anti-elitism. And of course I've been brought up with this, as I said earlier, wearing pearls and twin sets for crying out loud. I mean, you can see by that photo that I was pretty docile. But she used to talk a lot about the Women's Information Switchboard. So I decided I was going to go to the Women's Information Switchboard and go to their meetings. So I did, and it was great down there in Kintore Avenue.
Can you remember when you started going there?
Oh, it would have been... Well, when did it was about 2 years before it moved down to Roma Mitchell.
If you bear with me, I have got that written down here somewhere. Let's have a look.
And that was... I was never sure about that, and neither was Barbara.
Moved to Station Arcade in 1997.
Yeah. Okay, well, it was about two...
So about
mid-90s. Yes.
And was it already called the Women's Information Support Group when you joined?
No.
It? What was it then?
It was the Switchboard something or other. I don't know.
So it was...
What's the name?
There wasn't people that were working at WISP, but it was like other organisations.
Yeah.
So were you representing WIRL?
When we moved down to Station Arcade, we were all very nervous, because we thought we were losing our autonomy.
Get to that in a minute. I really want to talk about the Kintore Avenue part.
Right.
So you represented WIS. How often were these meetings?
Well, I really can't remember. Look,
I'm
it might
month,
have been monthly.
Monthly. I've put a question. I think they were monthly, yeah.
But that's where I met, you know, Liz Ahern and all those.
Carmel was there at that time?
Carmel. She was just gorgeous. But Carmel, I understood, and Carmel, I think, helped me, because she also came from a middle-class background of, you know, do the right thing and be a nice girl. Yeah. And she understood that it was going to take me a while to liberate myself from those don't be too polite girl stuff.
Can you remember any of the other organisations that were in that group as you were representing WIRL?
There's lots. We used to have meetings of 50-odd women.
Wow.
All the churches were represented. Giddy aunt, there were lots and lots.
Have a look at that list I've just left you. Is there any of those that ring a bell from those early days?
And, of course, a lot of women pollies came along.
They were very supportive, weren't they?
Yeah, they were great. But we were very, very suspicious. Oh, Alison Jen. Yeah. Dear old Alison.
Oh, yes, yes.
She was great. Of course, she lived just down the road. So I saw a fair bit of Alison. Oh, have a look at them all. Yes, Beta Sigma Phi, Catholic Women's League, yes, Church Women, AFUW. I was not yet a member of AFUW, but there was another.
You became heavily involved later.
Democrats, they were all there. Yeah, know all them. Mm-hmm. I don't remember child and home safety. Oh, the breast screen girl. What was her name? She was fantastic. No, I can't remember. Yes. The Asian women's group, Pan Pacific or something. Churches of Christ, CWA. Oh, yeah.
The YW, were they?
Yes.
Were they there early too?
Yes, definitely. Yes, she was on executive. What was her name? Blonde curly hair. Not very chatty. Not Denise. Something like that. Yes. Tea Tree Gully, now there were. Tea Tree Gully, YWCA, she used to come along. National Council of Women, of course. Nursing Mothers, Mothers Union, Legal Services. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, all them. Yes, nurses, rape crisis. Oh, there's Janine.
Don't bother going through it. What we've identified there is it was a real cross-section
of society. Wonderful.
And it wasn't what you would traditionally call a group of feminists. It was a group of women representing every other woman that was around.
And that made it very difficult when the time came for us to gather around and talk about the abortion law reform, because some of us didn't want it, some of us were dead against it, and lots of us were really very much for it and prepared to march the streets for it. And it did cause a lot of trouble. I don't know how Carmel ever managed that, because that was difficult.
So the whole time that you were there, Carmel was managing those meetings?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, she was wonderful. She had great people skills. And women really liked her and respected her, which was most important in that role.
What would you say at that early stage, even though you weren't a member of the working WIS group at Kintore Avenue, you were clearly heavily involved. What do you think was the strength of WIS? What were they about?
Giving women a voice, introducing women to each other, as friends and not competitors.
That's a good way of describing it. And did you think, through your involvement, that they were a feminist organisation?
I didn't have that label at the time, but by the mid-90s I was very proudly calling myself a feminist. But not a radical one, that scared me. I wasn't going to throw bombs and at the male politicians that I couldn't stand, but I was quite happy to write letters. I was quite happy to hold placards, walking on International Women's Day, go to meetings about abortion law reform, and of course later on we had the right to life and all that crap.
That's probably a good way of describing
it. Yes.
What did you see as the role of WIS support group? I think WIS had become quite established. Women knew what they were there for, what they're about. I've discussed with people that work there the sort of clients, the sort of advice and training that they got. But yours was a very different role.
Yes.
Because you weren't an employee or a volunteer, but you played an equally strong role in quite a different aspect. Mm. So as an early member of this group, what did you see your role as?
I was responsible for getting as many delegates from women's organisations around the place to come along to a quarterly meeting to talk about what they were trying to achieve, what their goals were, and to become familiar with the switchboard, with WIS, as their home base, and to meet other delegates. And there were times when that just got extremely difficult because a lot of organisations decided to fade away.
Oh, for what sort of reasons?
Well, a lot. If we had meetings after working hours, the older women didn't want to come. If we had meetings during working hours, the younger working ones couldn't come.
So when you started, when were they meeting?
Nighttime.
What?
Like, so women, half
six
past
o'clock,
six.
Half, right.
Half past six, and I used to say, you know, bring something to eat if you want to, or. But of course, the older ones were constantly. Heather Beckman, that's who I took over from. She was lovely.
So when did Heather take over the leadership of that group?
Heather led the group until 2000, when I took over.
But I think it would be fair to say that during that time you were a very strong deputy.
Yes.
I mean, we saw you as taking over.
Yeah.
It was all not a deputy, but almost a shared leadership to a degree. Would that be a fair comment?
I didn't mean to. I was just super keen. And I could see that while Heather was really good at the advocacy, she was great at letter writing to politicians or whoever needed to be written to, keeping in touch, and being a strong Democrat, she was far more involved in politics than I was. But I could see that a lot of that was too academic for some of the younger ones who were trying to represent their local, you know, it may have been school or kindy or YW or church groups, and I didn't want it to be too academic, but it had to be a little bit because that was the purpose of the advocacy. And Heather and
I... So it was getting that balance, wasn't it?
Yeah. And we worked really well together, I thought. Then poor old Heather, her husband died and she dropped her bundle, poor love. So I just kept it going, thinking that she could come back when she felt a bit stronger and her life levelled out, but she moved on instead.
And you were well prepared, having in that deputy role, so
it
was probably a godsend in a way that you'd had that strong bond with Heather in working together.
Oh, yeah, yes, and also with Carmel.
I didn't have the opportunity of meeting or working with Heather. My time on the support group was entirely with you, so I have no comparison.
Oh, right.
During that time, you were always so full of energy and drive. Yeah. Was that just part of your development as a feminist and as a woman?
I think so.
Yeah.
I was just charged by it all. And I just kept in touch with... it was just amazing. Now, I think back on it now and I don't know how I did it. You know, with three kids on my own, working, and I just loved a whiz. And I had papers all over the place. And that's when I started to get political. I didn't join a party because every time I thought of joining a party, one of the men would do something that incensed me. And to this very day, I'm not sorry, because there are still some men there that I'd like to punch their lights.
Well, I can't ask you on tape because that would be libelous.
Oh.
But you can tell me afterwards. You never joined a party at any stage after that?
Nope.
But your political views would have been clear.
Oh, yes. I think everybody knew that
and
one of the strengths of
the committee I found, not that they were always able to attend because it often clashed with the parliamentary sitting, but there were a lot of politicians committed to that group, weren't they? Who were some of them?
Well, some of them were committed and some of them were there for what they could get out of it.
Let's do the committed ones first. So then we'll... Can you remember some of the ones that you felt were really behind you?
Oh, Sandra was wonderful.
Yeah. She's still very active.
Oh, she's stunning. Sandra was just...
Sorry, I should say for the record, Sandra Kank.
Frances was always around. Mm-hmm. Steph was magnificent. I never got on at all well with the lady from Port Augusta.
Lynn Brewer.
And she said to me one day, she's got no time for feminism. And I thought, uh-oh. Even when she was the speaker in the house, we didn't get on. Isn't that funny? Look, there was Sot.
Tammy Franks was there from the Greens.
Oh, Tammy, yeah. Well, she was YW.
She was at that stage, that's right.
Yeah.
Just trying to think.
Sandra from Working Women's Centre.
Sandra
was
Dan.
Fantastic, yeah.
By the way, she still is.
Oh, she still is. Isn't she gorgeous? Yes. Look, there's been lots of women that have come along for a couple of years and then someone else has come. But most of the women Pollies were... Now, there's people like Vicky Chapman. Now, she would come along sometimes.
And she was there from the very start.
Yes, and she was a member with Women's Electoral Lobby for a long time too. But she never really relaxed into the way most women relaxed when they get with a crowd of other women. She always had a bit of a... Excuse me, that's my refrigerator. Mm. She had a sort of defensive... it was interesting. And there were a couple of others... Polly, there was one from Port Lincoln, I can't remember her name. She came along for quite a while. If our meetings coincided with sitting dates, she would come in. But I did notice that as the advocacy dropped off, so did they, which said to me that there were quite a few there to hear what we were saying rather than to come along and be a part of it. And that got trickier as time went on, because towards the end, as you will know, the same old ones were coming along meeting after meeting, and none of them were interested in the advocacy. I'd talk about, for example, the... what was it called? The right to die.
Voluntary euthanasia.
And I'd say, you know, can we all agree on a point of view that we can write in... No one ever volunteered to write the letter. I knew that abortion law reform was going to come up again, and it will now, which pains me, but someone else is going to have
to. Just reminded me of another name, Anne Levy, when you said abortion law reform.
Anne came all the time, as did Heather Southcott, of course.
Sorry for interrupting there.
Yes, just Anne. Yeah. Oh, dear old Anne. She's okay. Haven't seen her for a couple of years.
Yes. Still see her at functions here and there.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So I noticed towards the end, the word I latch on is old. It tended to be women from a whole range of organisations that had been there from the start. And the only thing they were really interested in was their own organisation, happy to share information, which was a good part of the meetings, as to what was on, but not really interested in anything outside of that view.
No.
And it was clear it was going to end because you were the only activist on the group.
Yeah.
Over the many years that you were involved, what were some of the issues that the group did get involved in, whether it be advocacy, letter writing, whatever sorts of things? Because the big ones you have mentioned were abortion law reform and certainly of more recent times, the voluntary euthanasia.
We also did a fair bit with public transport, disability issues, older women's issues, social security. Social security was a very interesting one, because things were changing in those areas and not necessarily for the better. You know, things like single mums were having a pretty tough time and still are, I believe. What else? You know, when I think now about the sexual assault, we didn't even stop and think about that.
And domestic violence, I don't think we really were onto until quite late either.
No, we weren't. You're right. Domestic violence was something that happened to other people.
And as a general rule, I hate to generalise, but most of those women on the committee were probably middle class.
Yes.
Perhaps mm-hmm. not exposed to
no.
some of those.
No.
I mean,
even if they were, nobody talked about it.
They wouldn't have talked about it. That was just exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
It impacts on every part of society, but that particular group, if it was happening, wouldn't talk about it. And I think that's the big leap we've made now.
That's right. One thing I did try really hard to do, but it just failed at every turn, was to get Indigenous representation. I remember talking with Cheryl Axelby, who was at that time at the Aboriginal Law. God, I can't remember it. Was it ALRM? I can't remember.
Could have been.
Yeah. Because I was really aware that there was a division. You know, we had women there from overseas, we had refugee representation, but our own Aboriginal women were nowhere to be seen. And thanks to Carmel, that gradually changed, and now we have the Aboriginal women's health get-togethers and all that stuff. But to get a delegate to come along to a meeting was just, that was too hard. Now, Maria Lane, she came a couple of times representing the Federation of Graduate Women. She was fantastic. She was also a lecturer at one of the universities in Aboriginal something or other.
Part of your role was working with the paid staff at WIS, and we always had a manager's report, and 99 times out of 100 we would have the manager there at the meetings, showing their support for what we did. Who were the managers or the WIS staff that you worked directly with?
Heavens. After Carmel. Who came after Carmel? We had all sorts of people. We had Vaya Proyas.
Oh, yes, Vaya, yeah.
We had Sandra Dan. We had, oh dear.
I can't remember them either. That's why I'm pushing you to see if you can.
Oh. And of course we had, cortisone's taken a lot of my brain away, I'm afraid.
Let me have a look at my list.
That's terrible, isn't it? Oh. Oh, isn't that crazy? Yes, they used to present
report at
every meeting about what they were doing and how we could be involved and all sorts of stuff. You know, Bridget Wansey, of course, she came. Remember Bridget? Yeah, she was there. She was one of the older ones.
One of the other things that I liked that you did, when you'd always do the minutes, or occasionally you get the odd helper, but 99 times it was you that was doing the minutes. And you had difficulty writing, so I was a little bit mean.
Yeah.
But when you sent out the minutes, you always included clippings from the press relating to women's issues, many of which we didn't see because I don't necessarily get the advertiser and things like that.
Of course not.
And that must have taken you quite a bit of time to compile. Yeah.
But I thought it was important. I thought it was important for not everybody receives a paper. Sometimes I get interstate papers. And, of course, being in Women's Electoral Lobby, they would send me a copy if there was something in a Sydney paper or a Melbourne paper. And I thought they were important enough to share, but also our own things, you know, with Steph's office was always very, very good if I needed anything like that. And back in those days, of course, I don't know why, but I, when I was working with children's television, I also did a lot of paper reading there to keep up with what was going on in the media.
So it's a habit you maintain.
It's a habit I maintain. And it still fascinates. I'm still a newspaper person. I'll never get over it.
There is something I do want to talk about, and you touched on it earlier. You started at Kintore Avenue, the Institute building. Then the big decision was made to move down to Station Arcade. I'm not sure what the reasoning...
That was Diana. The Liberal Party got in, and Diana wanted us in one place with the Office for Women, where Carmel was the boss, of course. But half of us were excited and half of us were very nervous. The older women, most of the older women, were very cautious.
Why was that?
Because if the government is paying for you to do your work, then the government is going to want to keep a foot on you. And we were really concerned that there would be pressure from the minister on the way we ran WIS.
Did you find that happened?
There was an influence, but because that influence was Diana, it was really easy to understand and it didn't really make things difficult. Simply because when the Liberal Party came into power, we were able to present to Diana to take to the executive a minute of one of our very early meetings where David Tonkin was present and he was minuted as saying the Liberal Party will always support the Women's Information Switchboard without interference.
Okay,
anyway.
So the move worked.
This was thanks to Don Dunstan.
Yes, of course, because he started it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, he didn't, but he was the first one to come along and say the government should be supporting
that's
you.
That's right, he saw the need.
Yes.
Then the next and final move is to where it currently is in Grenfell Street. Because you'd already made that one move, I guess that second one was a little bit easier. And again, moving with the department was the focus. Well, so you've worked in all three of those environments.
Yeah.
Was your heart mainly with the first one at the Institute?
Oh, yeah.
Because that was the women's hub in Adelaide, wasn't it?
Yeah.
People still mention that it was such a friendly organisation.
It was great.
And it was this little haven for Adelaide women. That's how you'd
lefty
still see
women.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great, and I could take my kids in there, and nobody went tut tut tut. There, you know, it was never quite the same after that. I know that the two offices that we've had since, we've nearly always had a children's corner, but
it's not the same.
It's not the same. Not when you've got old couches and tatty old rugs on the floor and radical stuff hanging from the ceiling.
And on that really positive note, we'll stop the interview for today. And thank you very much. That was delightful.
Oh, good.
Thank you. Oh.